How did you think of that? With Temple Grandin.
And I'm Sherry Quinn. We seek out innovators, educators, and researchers who approach challenges with their own unique abilities, such as the way Temple Grandin uses visual thinking to approach problems and discover solutions. Listen to the Genuine is in two segments. First, Temple Grandin is joined by Maya Ajmera.
It's always fun to be able to tell the story.
President and CEO of Society for Science and publisher of its award-winning magazine, Science News. She is also the recipient of the 2020 National Science Board Public Service Award. The Society for Science is well known for its national and international science competitions, including the Regeneron Science Talent Search and the Regeneron International Science and Engineering Fair. Later in the show, we hear from the top three winners of the 2022 Regeneron Science Talent Search, the nation's most prestigious science and math competition for high school seniors. They share what it takes to become a superstar STEM researcher. So grab a notebook, call your favorite teacher, and enjoy the show. Maya Ajmera's contribution to the public's understanding of STEM are extraordinary, but there's more. She founded the Global Fund for Children and is an award-winning children's book author. Let's dive in and learn from these visionaries. Here goes. Maya was exposed to science at an early age.
I'm the daughter of Indian immigrants, brought up in Eastern North Carolina, and my father was a physicist and mother an entrepreneur. And I thought I was going to become a doctor or scientist. I did science projects growing up and did a lot of hands-on tinkering, as they say, in a lab, but outside the lab, and majored in neuroscience in college. But before that, I did a lot of science fair and a lot of science competitions and went on to found the Global Fund for Children, which I led, built, and led for 17 years, and then came on to lead the Society for Science since 2014, and really taking the organization to new heights, really making sure that every young person in this country can become a scientist or engineer if that's what they want to be when they grow up.
Temple and Maya discussed the importance of inspirational teachers and hands-on STEM experiences in schools. Maya shares a story about one of the teachers who inspired her.
My inspirational science teacher was Mr. Rick Wilkerson in sixth grade. And Mr. Wilkerson made learning a lot of fun, and he made science a lot of fun. And one of the things he did is he brought an old chicken incubator, and we grew chicken eggs in the incubator. And every 3 days, we would be paired up with two students, and we'd have a petri dish and a tweezers, and we'd open up the egg and see the growth of the embryo, the chicken embryo, over time. And that was really cool. The other thing he did was bring cow eyes to learn about the eye, and we would learn about the cornea and the iris and, you know, the retina. And it was all kind of gross at that time, but also really cool. It was a hands-on science, right? He made science learning fun.
Well, I think one of the things that's really bad that's happened in a lot of schools is taken out so many hands-on things. You have all this emphasis on testing. And when I was out working on designing livestock equipment and working with really large meat companies, I worked with skilled tradespeople that had like 20 patents, had their own shop patenting equipment, you know, and building it for major companies. And a lot of these guys were either autistic, dyslexic, or ADHD. And what saved them was a single auto shop class or a single welding class. Now, that's not for everybody, but if schools take out all these things, then you don't get a chance to try a whole bunch of different stuff like cooking and sewing and woodworking and theater, science labs and science fairs and projects like that. We still have FFA, which is a really good program, you know, get kids interested in agriculture. It also teaches them things like public speaking and
yes,
important skills.
Well, there's some great organizations that really support sort of this idea of tinkering. Future Farmers of America, 4-H Club, the Society for Science, which includes our over 300 plus science fairs in the United States and another 100 around the world. You cannot learn science by reading a book. You can't learn engineering by reading a textbook. The only way you learn science is by doing it.
I feel very strongly we've got to get kids interested in things, because I'm finding so many careers happen because kids get exposed to things. They get asked, well, how'd you end up in the cattle industry? Well, I was exposed to cattle when I was a teenager. Also, due to my big deficiencies in math, I couldn't do biomedical engineering. I had to drop that class. I couldn't do aerospace. I wanted to do that. But what I basically do in engineering is the whole field of industrial design. That's the visual side of engineering, and it often doesn't get enough credit.
So you said something really interesting about really smart kids being pushed into special ed. Tell me about that.
Well, you get a kid that might be a real smart math kid, but he's got some behavior problems. And sometimes those behavior problems are caused by being bored, because you're making him doing baby math instead of moving him ahead, or he's bullied horribly in school. And the only places I was not bullied in high school was friends who shared interests, things like model rockets. And Mr. Carlock was the head of the model rocket club. And I've had a lot of friends involved in that activity. And then, of course, riding horses, friends who shared interests. But you need us visual thinkers, because there's a lot of equipment that's being made in Europe now. Why is the most advanced chip making machine for making electronic chips? I've been getting into this industry, made in Holland. Well, when you take the covers off that thing, it's got lots of mechanical parts in there. Somebody had to make that stuff in a shop. That's my kind of mind. It's not given enough credit.
So, you know, when you talk about being with your people, meeting your people, right? Being around kids who share your interests. We see that at our science fairs,
our
science competitions. These individuals have been lonely. They've been working in isolation, and they finally come to our science fair, the International Science and Engineering Fair, and say, I found my people.
Yeah.
I found the individuals I can collaborate with. I found my best friends for life. And it's so interesting when you follow the trajectories of these young people over time, they're still in touch with each other. They're still friends. Some have started companies together, but they found their people. And I think what you're talking about, the clubs, all of that, for kids that are special, this is very important.
These things are so important.
Temple Grandin in his researched patterns of thinking, modes of learning, and how people with different approaches, such as verbal or visual, can benefit each other and work together. Maya Ajmera, the author of 20 award-winning children's books, sees the benefits of nurturing visual thinking in infants and children.
So, you know, you talk about visual thinking, right? And my children's books are all photo illustrated in the sense that I want to have children see the reality of the lives of children all over the world.
Yeah.
Okay. And so one of my famous books, I have about 30 children's books, but one of my two famous books is Children from Australia to Zimbabwe. And it's a journey across the alphabet to 26 countries, but it really sees how children live in different countries. And then I have a board book that's for babies, and it's called Global Babies. And it's a bestseller because children love looking at themselves, at other kids. And for us, when we think about inclusion, you have to start very early. And so these board books, which is for babies, they look at these images and you think about what's being imprinted in their brains when they see a child, for a baby from India, or a baby from Portugal, or a baby from Brazil, or a baby in from Alabama. They actually imprint this. And so that visual sort of imprinting and thinking is absolutely critical. And it starts at when you're a baby, frankly.
Well, there is research that I have looked up that children tend to be more visual.
So Temple, with visual thinking, how do you think about teaching that in the classroom?
You know, you can teach it somewhat, but it's also innate, especially if you have your extreme mathematician, who's going to be a brilliant physicist. And then you've got the object visualizer like me, and teaching me algebra was just hopeless. And a lot of the brilliant people I worked with in the metal shops, they also could not do algebra. I mean, I'm talking about two guys got corporate jets, and one of them invented this whole big fantastic food factory, and we discussed all the labels he would have had. They can't do algebra. They had to go the commercial route.
But you feel like it's innate. It's not something you can particularly.
I think in the extreme forms, it's innate.
Okay.
Because there's a whole lot of work by a scientist named Kostikoff, and she never found an extreme object visualizer and an extreme mathematician in the same person. Now, a lot of people are sort of around in the middle, and there's a certain amount of flexibility there. But you're not going to make a mathematician out of me.
So tell me just a little bit about when our alumni and students listen to this interview and listen to you and get very inspired, they're going to say, well, how did Temple become a scientist? Like, what was that path like for her?
Okay. Can you tell us? I majored in psychology in college, partly because of the math issue. And then I switched over to animal science. And then for my master's degree, I limped through statistics with a C, the ton of tutoring. And then I worked on my PhD. And then started working for CSU just a quarter time to start with, I came up with some really innovative ideas. I have a paper by a student named Bridget Watson, one of my first graduate students. And when I thought up this idea for a paper, people thought it was just crazy. I said, well, we're going to score how much cattle get excited and agitated when you handle them in squeeze chutes. And I'm going to see if that's related to weight gain. We hit the jackpot. It was. And that's been replicated a whole bunch of times. But I started the whole field of temperament testing of cattle.
Wow.
And the thing is, I visualized it.
Maya shares her insights for guiding children and young adults towards their own career paths.
Listen to the genuine inside of you. That's one of the things. And listen to what's driving you. One of the things I ask young people all the time is not what do you want to be when you grow up? I don't ask that anymore. I ask, what problem do you want to solve when you grow up? And when you think about the problem that gets you riled up or excited, then things start clicking as to what courses I might want to take or what I want to do, right? So it's the problem you may want to solve, or what are the things that get you excited and passionate about, right? That's how kids need to think. It's not about courses. Oh, I've got to take algebra one or I've got to take history. It's about how do those things connect to the passion or the interest I have.
The Society for Science, remember they are champions for science and science literacy for all, brings science directly to the classroom. Their publication, Science News for Students, is available for teachers at no cost and focuses on providing inspiring and accurate science information that is relevant to students.
Temple, are you worried about misinformation in science?
Absolutely. I can't believe some of the garbage that people believe. And some of that's gotten to be, so politically a hot potato, I'm not even going to discuss it. Well, I think I can discuss this one, that airplane trails are a government plot. It's like, how can you believe something that, to me, is like so stupid?
Well, this is why science news is so important.
That's
the
right.
Incredible science journalism is very, very important in our day and age. It's a core to our democracy. We actually have this wonderful program called Science News in High Schools.
Okay, good.
And we're in over 5,400 high schools across the country.
Good.
And what happens is a high school gets 10 copies of Science News. They also get a teaching guide every 2 weeks. And the STEM teachers become part of our community of nearly 20,000 STEM teachers. And all the kids in the high school get free digital access to Science News.
Well, that's just great.
Which has been really fun.
I want to support what you're doing. And we definitely need science literacy. And it's kind of scary, the stuff people believe. I read an interesting study about the stuff online, that if someone just makes a quick response, that's totally emotional. But if you force somebody to look at some of this fake news stuff and really study it, they can figure out the fake news and the real news.
Yes.
But they have to not do that quick emotional response. See, that's the thing that's so bad. The other thing is the algorithms automatically pick up stuff that gets the most clicks and the most and the longest engagement. And unfortunately, when you set the algorithm for maximum ad revenue, it has maximum garbage.
That's right.
And it's unfortunate, but that's what the algorithm does if it's just allowed set for maximum revenue. I mean, I look at things like, okay, I go on one of the major networks sites and click on the news, and then down below they get all this clickbait.
Oh, it's horrible.
And it gets increasingly weird.
And it's also really toxic for young
people. Oh, it's really toxic. That's the thing. And I think when the algorithms were made, they didn't realize that it would do this bad thing. And I think it's hard for some of the technical minds, some of the math minds, to come to the realization that this, some of this stuff is really bad.
Yeah, well, again, they're not good at uncontrolled variability.
And you get that quick, the other really bad thing is this quick response. Okay, so you see some real piece of garbage and you click on it, send it to a jillion people. And it's a quick emotional response. Now, if you just had like a 2-minute lag before it would send it.
Right.
That would probably help, but that would make less money.
I think you're right.
Yeah, see, that's wrong. I've read some of the stuff about this. You know, the AI program just does the math, but unfortunately, when it just blindly does the math, it promotes bad stuff.
In case you tuned in a little later, the Society for Science hosts international science fairs and provides resources and support for local fairs throughout the U.S.
One of the things I'm also really curious about is being an animal scientist, as you are. You know, one of our most favorite categories at the International Science and Engineering Fair is animal sciences. We have kids who come from all over the world doing research projects in animal science, and they're very exciting, and we should have you come visit sometime.
Well, that would be something I would like to do. And animal science has really progressed. When I first started, when I did those papers on the cattle temperament back in the early 90s, and Bridget Busnay, my student, I did all the work. I wasn't allowed to use the word fear in a paper. I had to say that the cattle were agitated. Now, yes, it's very clear. The neuroscience has shown that, yes, animals definitely do have emotions. But it took a long time to recognize that because I had a reviewer cross the fear word out. That's why I've got a paper where it has agitated behavior in the title, because I was forced by reviewers to use that. They said, well, it's not scientific to say animals have emotions. That's giving them human emotions. Well, now later brain research has shown, yes, they do have emotions.
You know, when I think about our work at the Society for Science, I'm always amazed by the ingenuity and creativity of young people and the problem-solving skills that they have. And I think what really gets them excited is seeing a problem in their community and figuring out how to solve it, yeah. Or something or a problem that's happened in their own family. And how do I solve it? If my mother or grandmother had cancer, well, I'm going to actually figure that out, right? Or if it's climate change, what's going on in my own community to fix that? And that's been very exciting.
I read an article, it was either in Science or Nature, about the lady that's working on the Norovax, and that very poor family, next door neighbor paid her bus fare so she could go to school, and her dad always supported her going into science, and she says she wanted to become a doctor and find a cure for something. And I got kind of emotional when I read that story.
Yeah, that's how these stories are, of how that spark is created. And so for the kids that we serve, it's pretty extraordinary. And we serve them from middle school on, from sixth grade on.
Well, and there's a lot of creative stuff you can do that's not very expensive. You know, go out in the park and observe animals.
Yes.
Well, there was one enterprising teacher, she took her kids out and they were going to observe, figure out how much money the city made from parking tickets. I mean, and it was just really clever and interesting.
It's very interesting how students are also using artificial intelligence and machine learning in their work. What is your feelings about that?
Well, it depends how they're using it. I mean, artificial intelligence program is only as good as its training.
Right.
And how are they using it?
Well, they're using it in many different ways. There's projects on detecting wildfires, right? Or counting numbers of fish, right? Or because of climate change, but using AI to do that. It's how they use it, but the ethics of it is very interesting.
As a visual thinker, I've been very interested in pasture management and using cattle in a really sustainable way as grazing programs. I'm really interested in that. And I've been learning all about these different satellites and the things they can see, which I think is just fabulous. But I always got to say, we've got to calibrate that back to the ground. That
interesting.
What you're sensing with that special camera and how it reflects actually on the ground. It's got to be calibrated with measurements taken on the ground. And I get a little worried about modeling going just too far.
Oh, that's a very interesting.
You always want to get back to what's happening in the real world.
Well, you know, it's just something to really think about. I think back to my last job, which was founding the Global Fund for Children and supporting these innovative nonprofit organizations throughout the world. And I think about all of the extraordinary young people I met through that work. And I'm always enamored by the children I always met on the street, right? They would be selling things that they had made or tinkering, but always this brilliance of energy and brilliance of survival and brilliance of making things happen. And I just feel like that energy just has to keep going for young people throughout the world.
Well, this is where good teachers can make a difference. Mentors.
Before becoming CEO for the Society for Science, Maya founded the Global Fund for Children, an international nonprofit that invests in community-based organizations that benefit children's education, equity, empowerment, and freedom. Maya shares with us the motivation behind the organization and the impact of the community projects they support.
I was on my way to get an MD PhD. I graduated from college. I got a fellowship that allowed me to travel from Thailand to Pakistan for a year, and had wonderful professors who said to me, Maya, if you really want to understand people and their aspirations, get a backpack and start traveling. And so I did that. And it was in India, where my parents are from, is where I say I had my moment of obligation. I was in a train platform in northeastern India. You experience that chaos, but among that chaos, I saw 50 kids sitting in a circle learning how to read and write. And there was a teacher teaching them with flashcards. And I asked the teacher what was going on. And I spoke Hindi and she spoke the local language and we were able to communicate. And she said, these children live on and around the train platform. They work, they play, they beg, they sleep, they eat, but they don't go to school. So a teacher said, you know, instead of bringing these kids to school, I'm going to bring the school to the train platform. And she brought a basket of magic, is what she called it, with chalk and slates and puppets. And she had one kid and then two and then four and then eight. And all of a sudden she had a train platform school. And when the teacher told me, I said, what does it cost to run one of these schools? And she said, it only costs $500 a year for two teachers and a hot meal every day. And it's there that I had that moment of obligation. One, how do I help? And two, how come I don't see more train platform schools all over India? And that's where the idea of the Global Fund for Children came. How do we get small amounts of capital into really innovative grassroots organizations throughout the world, led by proximate leaders, led by individuals who are on the ground and understand their communities the best? And that's what I did. And I built it over 17 years. And today we've invested over $50 million in organizations throughout the world. And it's led by an extraordinary CEO, John Hecklinger. So as a founder, I revel in the fact that the organization is thriving without me. And now I lead the Society for Science. I went back to my science roots and led an organization that I feel very strongly about, because I was working to support and nonprofits were alleviating poverty at the grassroots. I'm now supporting young people who are trying to solve the biggest global challenges in the world. And they're using science and engineering to do that. And that only can help the children on the ground, right, who are being supported. But, you know, that kid on the train platform may be having much hotter summers because of climate change. They may be having not great water because the water is polluted, right? So I see the link of my work with the Global Fund for Children and my work with the Society for Science, especially these STEM action grants that we make throughout the country. So that was the organization I talked about that we supported in Brooklyn, of kids with, I call them all kinds of minds. They think very differently, and helping to support them.
Maya has many examples of direct impact. One that particularly stands out is the secret homeschools for girls that started when the Taliban made it illegal for girls to receive an education in the late 1990s.
So an extraordinary woman named Dr. Sakina Akubi, who was going across from Pakistan to Afghanistan to teach mothers and teachers how to teach girls secretly without getting killed. So how to leave the home without being noticed. We provide a $5,000 grant to support the organization before the downfall or the Taliban took over. The organization was supporting 400,000 women and children with education and healthcare in Afghanistan. And they're still operating, but Dr. Akubi is this extraordinarily fearless leader. Multiply her with the teacher at the train platform school. Multiply it with an organization called Kasaro in Cambodia that works with children of waste pickers, the big garbage dumps where children are working to pick garbage to sell. We call them recyclers now, not waste pickers, but recyclers. But they don't go to school. So Kasaro started these mobile schools and health clinics next to these mounds of garbage. So kids and their parents could be together, but they would feel safe about going to school. These are the types of organizations we're supporting. And with our STEM action grants, with the Society for Science, you know, we supporting a group called Black Girls Dive. One of the big reasons that African-American children die in the summer is because they die in the pool because they don't know how to swim. So a founder said, I'm going to teach girls how to swim, but I'm also going to teach them marine biology. We gave them a grant. They now have gotten grants from NOAA and other places, and they're replicating their work. You know, we're supporting a group in South Dakota, the Sioux tribe, teaching STEM with Sioux culture in their learning. Those are the sorts of organizations we're trying to support where it's proximate, it's local, it's deep.
Maya and Temple are both leaders who have made enormous impacts in their fields and on individual lives and communities. Luckily, they had a handful of great teachers and mentors who helped guide them throughout their education and careers.
I've been looking into how a lot of people get into their careers. I got into cattle, at least I got exposed to them. But then I also had a good mentor on my design. There was a small contractor starting a tiny little steel and concrete business, a former Marine Corps captain. And he seeked me out to design projects for him and sell jobs. He also helped me set up my business. He was a very important mentor in getting my business started. So you have to have exposure to things. But then once you get the interest in going, then there is a need for mentors to help develop it.
Well, I feel very fortunate to have had great mentors in my career, from the scientists that I've worked with to role models to really extraordinary women leaders that have really given a lot of time and energy and effort and making sure that I'm learning. And I'm really grateful to that. You know, it's been such an honor to talk to you, Temple.
I want to support what you're doing, and we definitely need science literacy.
That was scientist Temple Grandin and Maya Ajmera, president and CEO of the Society for Science. In our next segment, we hear from the three top winners of the Regeneron Science Talent Competition, also known as STS. It is a program of the Society for Science and is the oldest and most prestigious science and mathematics competition. 1,804 high school seniors from 608 schools across the U.S. and 8 countries participated this year. Winners Christine Yeh, Victor Kai and Amber Lowell talk about their projects and recognize the mentors who inspired them and guided them towards their passions and dreams. Amber Lowell won third place and $150,000 for developing a software, Ribobase, that identifies key regions known as ribosome pause sites along a cell's mRNA transcripts that regulate protein synthesis. According to the Society for Science, Ribobase enables researchers to gain a more complete view of the mechanisms underlying a wide range of diseases, such as Alzheimer's disease and cancers.
Now explain to me why this research is important. I know high school biology, but we would need to explain it for us normal folks to understand. Why is this research important?
Imagine as researchers, when we want to learn about a new disease, we want to be able to understand, for every single gene within the human body, what exactly is happening in these disease states. Why is this protein maybe not being produced in the right ways that we want it to? So what my research does is it looks at this process called translation, which is how the protein is produced for every single gene in the body, and it's able to tell researchers precisely what is happening behind the scenes.
Okay, in other words, what this will do is a much more precise genomic mapping, and you can find out exactly where different diseases are causing abnormalities in this.
Yes.
Okay, that's really wonderful.
Christine Yeh won first place and $250,000 for her project, which analyzed the gravitational waves emitted from huge collisions between neutron stars and black holes.
So for context, and black holes are objects with gravity so strong that not even light can escape them. And neutron stars are basically on the verge of becoming black holes. They are the super dense collapsed cores of dead stars, and they are basically the same density as the nucleus of an atom, if you can imagine that really, really extreme condition. And so what I studied was when these objects are, out in the universe, they can form in binary pairs where you have a black hole and a black hole, or a neutron star and a neutron star. Or I studied the case of a black hole and a neutron star. And these binary pairs can actually come together and collide in some of the most catastrophic events in the universe. And of course, when they collide, they actually send out these ripples in the fabric of space itself called gravitational waves. And we use detectors here on Earth, like LIGO or the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, to observe the waves in the fabric of space itself. And using those waves, we learn about the objects that produce them. We can measure things like how big the black hole is or how fast the neutron star is spinning. And those quantities tell us really interesting things about astrophysics and physics, from, the physics of matter at very, very high densities to the astrophysics of how stars explode.
And I know something about black holes, so that's really cool.
And then, of course, for the big picture, I'm hoping to go to college and study physics. Of course, winning the Science Talent Search and that big prize does make that whole choice a lot easier for me. But also, I'm really excited to see kind of what doors STS opens. I've already been connecting with several alumni that are in kind of my field who work at, the universities I was working at. And so I'm just hoping to see all the incredible opportunities that come with this amazing competition.
Second place winner Victor Kai from Pennsylvania won $175,000 for his creation of a short-range, narrow-bandwidth radar that calculates distance by transmitting two signals at different frequencies and then measuring the phase between them. His research could help pave the way for more self-driving vehicles with less concern over bandwidth.
An inspiration for my project came from my karate teacher, who is visually impaired. His eyesight has been deteriorating over the years, and I wanted to do something to help him. And so I came up with this idea for a digital guide dog that could help him and other visually impaired people to navigate their houses. The main contribution that my project made was that it was able to use over 5 magnitudes less bandwidth than a traditional algorithm to achieve that same.
So in other words, radio frequency real estate's expensive. So in other words, you get a real accurate measurement using a smaller piece of the radio spectrum.
Yes.
And then, okay, let's say I'm your angel investor. You got to tell me what kind of wonderful new device I might be able to use this in.
Yes. So There's a range of different applications. One is in autonomous vehicles, which will need accurate medium to short range distance sensing. And current automotive technology for autonomous vehicles uses ultra wideband. There's actually a whole 4 gigahertz bandwidth dedicated just for autonomous vehicles radar. And so each one would require a whole 1 gigahertz in order to operate. So if autonomous vehicles are to become popular, we're going to need to reduce that bandwidth requirement.
Oh, by reducing the bandwidth, I can have more vehicles there in a small place and not have their radio distance finders mess up with each other.
Exactly.
Okay, I can relate to that.
Amber says her inspiration was not from one person or event.
Kind of like a culmination of my life's journey in kind of a way. So I grew up in Texas and I lived there for 14 years. And like ever since I was young, I was like a math girl. I would go to a lot of math camps and everything. And I kind of considered math as the only thing that really interested me. Like it was my only passion from when I was very young. And so like I kind of had a foundation in mathematics as a child. And then I moved to like Long Island, which is, you know, in New York, and I kind of had to leave behind my math childhood. And I had to find something else that I could kind of like find a community and find like solace in. So then I got into like biology, and then like there came a time when I really wanted to be able to integrate math and biology together in some sort of way. And then I became very interested in like, you know, is there a way that I can use math, which is like modeling, you know, very complex systems to understand biology, which is at its core a very complex field. So then I got very interested in computational biology research, and that kind of led me to my project and where I am today. So I would like search for internships in the field of computational biology, just like the entire motive behind my project was to use math to solve biological questions.
And like Temple Grandin and Maya Ejimera when they were her age, Amber had mentors.
Definitely the biggest one is my Science Olympiad coach, Ms. Saragano. She's been my Science Olympiad coach for 3 years now, ever since sophomore year. And she was also my research teacher in sophomore year. So it was her who first like recognized, I guess, a potential in research and kind of fostered that passion for learning and for science in me. So I'm really, really grateful for everything she's done for me. And then I was matched with a mentor from the University of Texas at Austin called Dr. John Senek. I applied to this program called RSI, a Research Science Institute, and then the staff there, and they matched me with Dr. John Senek from UT Austin based on my interest for computational biology, and then talked with each other, and he read my application and everything, and then together we decided, like, okay, like, we should definitely work on some sort of, like, computational biology project, and that brought me to where I am now.
These young science superstars have some advice for students seeking a career in STEM.
If you really, really love something, like, you will go that far to chase something that you're passionate about. So, like, if you have that determination, if you have that feeling that, like, you know, I would rather, like, stay up until 3 or 4 a.m. working on my research than sleeping, like, that's when you know you found something that you really, really love. And it's, like, that kind of, that you want to go deep, that you want to, like, chase this passion or this project as far as you can, that's what goes into like becoming an STS finalist or like an Olympiad winner or something like that. Like it's that kind of dedication and passion that needs to be there. So for people who want to like get into the sciences, you know, you have to build up to this point. The first thing, and I think the biggest thing, is always to surround yourself with like a STEM community. For me, that was Science Olympiad. For other people, like maybe that's some programs like CTY. I know a lot of people have like research clubs at their schools. So like whatever kind of STEM community there is around you, or even online, there's a lot of new like nonprofits for STEM popping up. So like definitely there's so many opportunities you could explore. And then after you found a community like that, find a field that you love, whether it's like astrophysics or computational biology, or like, I don't know, quantum mechanics, like find something that really interests you, you know, read a lot of textbooks, watch videos, just explore it and see if you like really, really love what you're doing. Because you, in order to have like big accomplishments in a field, in order to like really go very far with something, you have to love it. Like that's the most important part.
I also like to shout out to Science Olympiad. Science Olympiad was really important for me. But also I want to emphasize that I guess your community doesn't have to be a traditional format of like a research club at your school. A lot of the people we met, like, were the only people from their school to do research or didn't have this kind of like organized structure. But you can still find this kind of community in new ways. You know, you can make friends within your own field. I always encourage people to like go to conferences and try to meet people that way, or finding online communities that are, again, popping up through these nonprofits. So, you know, even if there's not really a strong community in your area or at your school, that's not a reason to give up hope.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, like, a lot of times a lot of us will feel like we haven't really gone anywhere with our projects. We get that imposter syndrome, and that's like perfectly normal to underestimate your own work like that, and really just be confident in what you have done and be proud of the work that you were able to accomplish, and don't be afraid to share that to whatever communities that you might be in, or even communities that you haven't tapped into yet.
The thing to say before I sign off is you're doing fabulous research. I know it's important, but we've got to convince people outside your field that what you do is important. But that's just something to think about, sort of crossing the divide between, okay, you're highly specialized people and some private equity company wants to fund you, but you've got to explain to them what that technology is going to do for that self-driving car. And just very simply, just one or two sentences, sort of why this is important. I hope I've gotten you thinking. It was great talking to you. You know, go out there and have a great career in science. It's wonderful you're doing graduate student professional science level work right now. You are to be commended for that, and I'm going to have to say goodbye.
I just wanted to say a big thank you to Society for Science and to you and Dr. Grandin for like hosting us today. It's been a lot of fun. Thank you all so much.
Thank you so much, Temple.
Okay,
the advice.
Thank you.
Great.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye.
How'd You Think of That with Temple Grandin is a production of the Utah STEM Action Center.
Thank you so much for listening.
We hope you enjoyed the show and learned a little something too. Thanks to Jalene Bailey for production assistance and to Aparna Paul. They both made this episode possible and better. Also, thanks to Rebecca Baker and the Utah State University Music Department for music compositions. I'm Sherry Quinn.
This podcast is based upon work supported by the National Science Foundation under grant number 174-5674.